You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
A lot of schools have adopted the policy that there shouldn't be any penalties for turning homework in late or even not turning it in at all.
It's hard to imagine how that would have bad effects. Gee.
Exactly.
This is really complicated. Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I'm delighted to welcome to the program today Idris Kaloun, who is a writer for The Atlantic and has written a piece about education that is pretty alarming and gripping stuff. So Idris, thanks so much for joining me. Before we jump into the substance of your piece and education policy in general, tell us a little bit about yourself. You used to be at The Economist. So where did you grow up? What was your education? What got you into journalism?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Sure. Yeah, I grew up mostly in Kentucky. I was born in Lexington, Kentucky. We then moved to New York City for a few years. My dad is a doctor. He was doing his residency and fellowship up there. So I was in New York City up until about age 7 or 8, and then we moved back to Kentucky. I finished my elementary school, middle school, high school, all there. Got a fantastic education at Paul Laurence Dunbar High School in Lexington.
Is that a public school?
It was a public school. It had a really good math and science magnet program. And so I got to learn all kinds of amazing things in high school, organic chemistry, linear algebra, had really good teachers. Felt really prepared for college. Which I did at Harvard. I did applied math and economics there. And I started writing then. I really liked it. I wanted to try to figure out a way to go into journalism and got lucky enough to start with The Economist after I graduated as a data journalist. So the math helped there, and was there for a year in London and then moved to DC. In 2017 to write about Trump and policy and all of that stuff. And I've stayed. So I was with The Economist until very recently. And I've just started my new job at The Atlantic, where I'm going to be writing about similar things, American politics, American policy, economics.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You are not the typical journalist story, because I wish I had a dime for every time I have heard a journalist say, I went into journalism because I was bad at math.
Well, so it's useful. It's useful for math.
It's very useful. All right. Well, that is a perfect segue into our discussion, actually, about how American kids are doing in math and in other subjects. So you wrote this piece, America is Sliding Toward Illiteracy. I guess you probably didn't write the headline. Writers rarely do. Yeah, okay. But tell us why you wrote this piece and what the point is.
Yeah, absolutely. So the point of the piece is to note that, you know, American education has really been on a downslide over the last 12 years. The highest level that we recorded in terms of fourth grade, eighth grade reading and math scores came in 2013. And since then, if you just look at the graph, it's just a steady decline. You know, that's important for a few things. For one, it erases a lot of the gains that were made from 2000. So from 2000 to 2013, there was a lot of improvement in American schools and American education. And what's happened is that this loss is of such magnitude that we've gone back basically to where we were in 2000.
So we lost all the gains and then some.
And yeah, we're about at 2000 levels. And if you look at other metrics as well, you see other signs of loss. So I don't know how many people have written about this. I didn't find that many articles. But when I was researching this, I noticed that ACT scores, which most kids who are graduating take, are at their lowest level since 1990, which is when the test was redesigned. So it's the last year that we have that's comparable data to what we have now. And that's a 35-year low that we've hit. So on a lot of different metrics, American kids look like they're not learning as well, both in reading and in math. In some cases, it seems like we're going backwards in a lot of ways. And I guess one other very disturbing but important fact pattern is that inequality in terms of educational outcomes is also increasing. So if you're at the top of the class, you're doing about as well as other kids who are at the top of the class were 10 years ago. But if you're at the bottom, you're doing a lot worse than kids who were at the bottom 10th or bottom 25th percentile were. And that, I think that's a really important thing for people to know.
You say in the piece, 33% of eighth graders are reading at a level that is below basic. Tell us what below basic means.
Yeah, but below basic is an inability to understand, given a passage of text, to even recount what the main events are, to be able to say very rudimentary details about what's happened in the passage. We're not at the level of interpretation or literary analysis. It's basically just, can you summarize the text that's being provided to you? And you know, that's a problem for a lot of reasons. First of all, you know, if you struggle with reading at that level, your ability to really understand and do well in any other subject is limited because all of them require reading. Secondly, you know, there's an idea that goes around that maybe, you know, we can use LLMs and chatbots and kind of automate our thinking. But you actually do need to read and engage with things constructively in order to even be able to make the best use of those kinds of tools. So even for, and maybe we'll get into this later, but even for the kinds of people who think that like technology is going to save us from this, I don't know that it is if you have a mass of kids who are at that level. I think it's a disturbing development.
By the way, I have a son who is teaching at the university level, and there have also, and I've heard this from him, and also from, there have been a number of articles recently, I'm sure you've seen them, about how even college students, so these are people who are at the upper end of the performance scale, even college students now find it difficult to read a whole book, they say. College professors are finding it difficult to get students to read whole books. They've been used to getting short excerpts.
Can I just say, I've heard that as well from a lot of people who teach. And there's a report that was published in the Harvard Crimson today. There was a study done of grade inflation at Harvard, which has increased in the 10 years since I went there pretty much. And they've also noted the same thing there, which is that grades are increasing and teachers are not assigning novels. They're assigning excerpts, short stories, these sorts of things. They're substituting away to less demanding work. And they don't expect any, and the kids are now even struggling to read. I shouldn't say kids, they're adults, but they're struggling to read even those passages. So it's something that I've heard, that I've seen, and, you know, and, yeah. and it trickles all the way up.
So we are drifting down, and most of the problem, though we've described, it's not limited to those at the lower end, but the problem is the most severe for the most disadvantaged kids, who had been making progress, in the period from 2000 to about 2010, 2012, right? So what do you attribute the progress to?
You know, there are going to be a lot of factors that enter into that, but obviously the big change that was happening to American education at the time was No Child Left Behind, and which gets a bad rap, and people graft their own views onto whatever that is.
Right.
But the essential idea was that schools have to have minimum standards. They have to have standards of proficiency for set numbers of their kids to meet, and they have to show improvement over time. And if they didn't meet those standards, there would be accountability. There would be, in some cases, loss of funding, in some cases, supervision, these sorts of things. But schools were going to be assessed based on how well they taught kids, and especially the kids at the bottom. So that was the big change that happened over this time period. But there were other things that were going on as well. You know, this was post Clinton boom. We had changes in, you know, child poverty, which is something else that I've written about over the time, was declining as well. You know, there were lots of things that were going on, but there are good studies that examine what happened after No Child Left Behind was in place and found that there were some modest improvements that we could attribute directly to the policy. But I think that it also set a culture of somewhat higher expectations for American kids.
Okay, so in your piece, you set out a series of arguments that people make about why educational outcomes are declining. And you start with spending. So this is the usual progressive or liberal reaction to problems with education, is to say we're not spending enough. So what's your view of that?
I just don't think there's that much evidence for it. You know, New York City, I read an article, is about to hit $42,000 per student in spending. And that per student covers a lot of things. That doesn't mean just spending on instructional resources for the kid. It includes all the educational costs. And those can, some school districts are larger than others. The number of non-teaching staff that we have in school districts has been growing over time. I was reading, it came up in the reporting, about 10 years ago, we passed the midpoint at which a majority of staff for school districts are no longer teachers. They're principals, guidance counselors, et cetera, other kinds of things. So there might be good reasons for that. You know, it might make sense that we have literacy coaches and speech pathologists and all sorts of other jobs.
Well, and some of this also is special education, right?
Right.
That's part of it.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, there are good reasons that we should be expanding. Anyway, I'm distracting myself. But the point is that, you know, you have places that spend a lot, like Chicago, like New York, that don't have spectacular outcomes. You have places, particularly in the South, that spend a lot less than schools in the Northeast, and have been turning out good results. So, you know, the amount of money that's spent, if it's spent in the right way, can improve outcomes. But if it's just spending for the sake of spending, then I don't think you see very much of a change. And the big point that I think is relevant to think about is, during the pandemic, we allocated as a country $190 billion to ameliorate the learning loss from the pandemic. And we didn't include very many restrictions on how schools were supposed to spend that money. Only 20% in one of the tranches was supposed to be devoted to direct tutoring. And in other cases, schools were free to spend it as they wished. And a lot of them spent it on capital improvements that maybe have been languishing, HVAC repairs, these sorts of things. You didn't see, as a result of that, a very big increase or change in student performance, because why would you?
Yeah, you quoted somebody in that part of the piece that was pretty blunt, right?
Yes, yes.
We didn't get jack shit for what we spent. That's what he said.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit like saying, well, the problem with American healthcare, which we all agree there are problems with American healthcare, the problem with it is the government doesn't spend enough on it. Mm-hmm. All we need is to spend more on it. I mean, you know, you can spend more on the right things, but if you keep spending more stuff on things that don't matter, then I don't think that they accumulate into magically good outcomes.
Okay. What about Jonathan Haidt, who says the problem is smartphones?
I think there's something to that thesis. I think that we all know how much phones have sapped our own productivity, and we imagine what happens to kids. Like, I feel very lucky that I grew up and was educated at a time when I didn't have an iPhone. And, you know, I was in college when I saw that kind of come in, and you saw noticeably how that changed the quality of the education that you got. And you know, another point in favor of the smartphone thesis is that the loss in learning outcomes is also not just seen in America. You see it across the OECD. A lot of the countries that take the PISA exam, which is international, also show losses in terms of reading and other points over time. But so while I think that that helps explain a lot of what's going on, and if you talk to teachers, a lot of them will say, you know, the phones are really inhibiting their ability to teach. I think it doesn't explain other characteristics of this. So it doesn't really explain to me why kids at the bottom would be doing dramatically worse than kids at the top. It doesn't explain to me why.
Because they have cell phones too. They have smartphones.
Exactly.
Everybody has. It's like 95% of the population, or 97% of the student population.
Exactly.
Has it.
So everyone has them. It could be that, you know, some kids have better kind of self-control, but I don't know. I don't think that would explain the whole thing. And the other point that to me points to something else going on is that over this time period where we've seen decreases in performance, we've also seen pretty dramatic increases in grades, pretty dramatic increases in graduation rates as well, which suggests to me that there's something going on at the school level as opposed to just the smartphones.
And of course, this is not true uniformly in all states, right? So there have been some states that have adopted. Well, I shouldn't jump ahead. Let's back up, because you don't think it's the smartphones. You don't think it's the spending. So your thesis is that it's low expectations, right?
Yeah. I think that helps explain a lot of what has happened. I think that we have expected less and less from kids, and kids have basically fallen to meet the occasion. And you see that crop up in a few ways. One thing I point to in the article is the rise of equitable grading.
Describe that. Tell us what that is.
It's the idea, which, again, I have brothers who are almost a decade younger than me, so I saw the differences in our education. But one thing that was different was if I took a test in high school, that was it. I did not. And what happens with them, I heard them talking once, is you could just retake the test if you didn't like the score that you got. Teachers, I remember, you know, you had to have your homework with you, because if you didn't, you would get a zero or a missing grade, or you'd be docked some points even if you turned it in late. A lot of schools have adopted the policy that that there shouldn't be any penalties for turning homework in late, or even not turning it in at all. And, you know, it's scaled up pretty dramatically.
It's hard to imagine how that would have bad effects. Gee.
Exactly.
I mean, it's really complicated.
Kids, and kids are clever. And so they know that if they don't have to do things, then they don't do them. But, you know, this is, you know, by some estimates, in 40% of middle schools, policies like this have taken hold. So I think that there is that. There are other changes as well that have happened. I mean, the grade trends that I pointed to earlier, the graduation rates that are increasing, all suggest, when we know that kids are performing at a lower level than they did 10 years ago, if their grades are improving and they're graduating higher rates, that means that the standard must be lower. I mean, mathematically, there's no other way that could be happening. So I think that bears a lot of explanation. And then maybe this was something you were going to get to, but, you know, the experience in all the states has not been equal. And that's probably been one of the most interesting things that we've seen over the last decade in education.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. By way of introduction, you didn't spend a lot of time on this in your piece, but I imagine you've looked into it and you alluded to it. Which is that American education has been the has been subject to fads. Many educational fads have come and gone. I am old enough that I was a victim of the new math fad that came around in the 1970s. And that, well, actually, it started in the 1960s. And Tom Lehrer of blessed memory skewered it in a great song, a parody song about new math. But that was just one of many fads that have pockmarked American education over the years. And so that was one. Another that is still causing damage to students, and I actually think it's incalculable the amount of damage that this particular fad has done. And I'm referring now to the way we teach reading. And the way we teach reading has been corrupted by the fad that came out of Teachers College, Columbia University. It's called whole language. It's also, there are a number of different names for it. But basically, it's the retreat from the science of reading. We know from study after study after study that the best way to teach children to read is phonics. Teach them to sound at that, you know, words, big words are composed of smaller parts, and you teach them how to recognize the smaller parts and sound it out, and it has meaning, and then that's what's on the page. This fad that has now become mainstreamed throughout American education across the country is no, that's not the way to teach students to read. Kids are really natural readers. They will do it on their own. All you have to do is show them the text and then ask them to guess based on the pictures, you know, what the next word is likely to be, or from context, ask them to guess. And this has led, I think, more than anything, to the dumbing down of American education. Your reaction?
Yeah, I think that, you know, whole language learning, balanced literacy, whatever name it goes by, you know, the idea is one that I think a bit sympathetic to, which is that if we encourage kids to love reading and have an environment in which books are ubiquitous, then they will become interested in it and sort of the cycle will self-perpetuate, and that kids can, you know, fill in from context clues, you know, ideas about what words might follow. But, you know,
Let's have a fight.
Please.
I totally disagree with that. Okay. I think reading, maybe a good analogy would be, okay, we want kids to love music. And we want them to appreciate music and have it be part of their life. And we want them all to play a musical instrument. So what we're going to do is we're going to put musical instruments in the classroom, and we're going to encourage them to just pick them up and pick at them or do whatever they want to do. And that way they will naturally learn how to play the violin, how to play the clarinet, how to play the piano. And it will just, you know, it will increase their love of it, and that'll work. And the answer is no, it won't. You have to teach them how to use the instruments, and then they will love it once they gain some mastery. But they can't just naturally do it. It's not like talking. Okay, talking is natural. You don't have to teach kids to do it. It's in our brains. We're born with the natural ability to speak and to understand. Reading is not like that. Reading has to be taught. You have to learn the rules, and then you have to apply them. And when you achieve certain mastery, and by the way, in situations where they have readopted phonics, and students learn to read this way, they also gain confidence. You mentioned this a minute ago. They gain confidence about their ability in all subjects, not just in reading.
Mm-hmm. No, I actually don't disagree with you. I was just trying to say that I understand, I guess, the sympathetically why you might think that this would work. I mean, you know, like we have a very young son who's less than a year old, and like one thing that we're
congratulations.
Thank you. It's great. I don't know what to do with my time before I had a kid, but you know, one thing that we're trying to do is, you know, have lots of books around and you know, have him flip through them, and you know, to your point, he's not going to learn to read until, you know, he learns his ABCs and he learns roughly the sounds that correspond with them. And, you know, and the evidence is that for kids who grow up surrounded by lots of books, maybe they're able to kind of self-perpetuate in a way that doesn't require that kind of very extensive phonics instruction. But for kids who don't have a lot of that at home, what we find is that really the only way you're going to get them to read is by teaching them that this is what a T sounds like. And if you want to sound out what the word frog is, you got to know what F means and R means and all of that. So I agree. And the... it's a nice idea, but as well.
Yeah. Like so many ideas in America, you know, it seems nicer, it seems gentler, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. And I don't know enough about gentle parenting yet, but that seems to me to be, maybe there's an analogy there between whole language and gentle parenting.
Maybe.
But yeah.
Actually, I mean, did you ever see the show Modern Family?
It was on. I've seen clips of it. I haven't sat down and watched episodes of it.
Well, I haven't seen very many episodes, but there is one episode where this gay couple is raising their child and they're explaining to their sister-in-law that they never want to say no to their daughter. You know, that's just not, and she's very skeptical, the sister-in-law. And then anyway, later on in the episode, there's a scene where the little girl has her fingers in the garbage disposal and is reaching for the switch on the wall. And the sister-in-law looks over.
You're never gonna say no? Are you sure that's how you want to express your emotions right now? Yeah.
Anyway, okay, speaking of getting sidetracked. But anyway, so all of this was background because back to the state comparisons. So one of the states in the country that always used to be the butt of jokes, because it was always at the bottom of every ranking for educational attainment and other things too, was Mississippi. And tell us about what they've done.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Kentucky, where, you know, the state motto was "Thank God for Mississippi," and I think that was the state motto in 40
Alabama.
Other states as well.
Yeah, right. But
yeah, Mississippi's astounding in a great way, because in 2013, they made a really big commitment towards early literacy, and they passed a law that emphasized phonics instruction. But it did a few other things as well that I think are important. People sometimes kind of reduce the whole debate into, do you teach like how to spell frog or how to sound out frog? But actually, it's a lot of things that have to happen at once. So what Mississippi did is very instructive. They did not just phonics education. They made sure that they would teach teachers the correct way to actually teach reading, because you have to remember, like you said about Columbia, teachers have been taught this is the way you're supposed to be telling kids how to read. And it's you know, it's tough also for teachers who, I think, the overwhelming, maybe all, want to do what's best for their kids. If they've been taught that for 10 years, they've been telling kids to do it this way, and suddenly it's another way. I mean, that's psychologically a bit difficult. So,
sure.
So you have to teach them. They also hired, I think, 75 literacy coaches who were just there to help, again, with this teaching of reading. Mm-hmm. And they were all sent to the worst performing school districts, basically the 75 worst performing schools. And they also said that if by third grade you didn't meet these reading requirements, you would be held back. You had to be able to read in order to go to fourth grade. And also, they were screening kids regularly before this. It wasn't like all of a sudden you just get a note at the end of the year, sorry, Johnny's not going to fourth grade.
Right.
And also, if a kid was held back, they weren't just going through the same coursework all over again. They were getting, you know, tailored remedial help in order to be able to actually catch up to where they needed to be. And lo and behold, 10 years later, Mississippi is doing phenomenally on reading scores. It is one of only two states, along with Louisiana, which adopted a very similar approach, that has actually seen improvement in fourth grade reading outcomes. And if you adjust for the fact that Mississippi has a poorer population, it is actually the best state in the country for young kids who are learning how to read. And it's doing that while spending less than a lot of places like Massachusetts or New York or other sorts of states. And there are a lot of lessons there, I think, for states.
Absolutely. And I want to underline something that you said, because it's so important. These interventions are the most important for the poorest and least advantaged kids. the ones who come from homes that don't have a lot of books around and don't, you know, have the advantage of highly literate parents and parents who have time, you know, to spend with them, et cetera. For them, it's even more important that they get this great grounding in literacy in the classroom, because it makes all the difference in the world to them. For the wealthy kids or the kids with better family environments, it's a little less crucial, right, to their life prospects.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Mississippi is now, at least, correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw some data that said that in terms of reading, they had gone from the absolute bottom to somewhere in the middle in the space of just a few years in terms of American states.
Yeah, it might be even close to the top now. Okay. And especially if you do the adjustment for socioeconomic status, I mean, they're unquestionably at the top.
Now let's take a moment and talk about one of our sponsors, Quince. I love this sponsor because Quince clothing is really great. I enjoy the whole experience. I enjoy their website, shopping. They have things that are just classically tailored, classically designed, simple, and just beautifully done and great on. They feel good and they look good. And their prices are unbelievably competitive. $50 Mongolian cashmere sweaters that are made for everyday wear. Denim that never goes out of style. Silk tops and skirts that add polish. And down outerwear that can take on the seasons. And it's getting chilly now, so it's time to think about your new winter wardrobe. It's also perfect for gifting. Holidays are coming up. The Quince Italian wool coats are at the top of my list. By working directly with ethical top-tier factories, Quince skips the middlemen and offers prices 50% less than similar brands. I was really amazed that when I got my cashmere sweater, which I adore, it also came with instructions, like here's how to care for your new cashmere sweater. And I did not realize this, but they said, don't dry clean it. It's better for the sweater if you gently wash it at home and air dry it, you know, spread it out flat. It will last longer and look better. Apparently, the chemicals in dry cleaning are not so good for your cashmere. But that's just an example of the kind of service that you get from Quince. The quality of the company is very much in evidence. So step into the holiday season with layers made to feel good, look polished, and last from Quince. Perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's Quince, quince.com/Mona to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Mona. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. Hey, let's look also at how the U.S. is faring vis-a-vis international competitors. So we spend way more than any of our competitors on education. Is that right?
I don't have it to hand, but okay. I would be surprised if we didn't. We spend a lot on everything.
Yeah, we do. But we don't. I mean, so how are we doing compared to other Organization of Economic Cooperation countries, OECD countries?
I would say we are comfortably middling.
Middling.
Last I checked, I think our scores were around Slovakia, 30th, maybe. I don't have them immediately in front of me.
Well,
but
here's
one.
It's out of the U.S. ranked 28th out of 37 OECD member countries in math. This was, let's see, the U.S. average score for math fell by 13 percentage points between 2018 and 2022, although other countries also saw declines.
Yeah, so that's participation trophy levels of performance, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have not we are not kind of stellar on education, internationally speaking. Some countries like China, I think, selectively pick who participates in that test. So yes. I don't.
So they don't test. They don't include in their results all of their children the way we do.
Yeah. Yeah. They have, you know, kind of well-run schools in Shanghai are more likely to take the test than.
And yet they have so many more people than we do. And that means that they have so many more excellent performers, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's a numerical advantage. And it used to be the case that a lot of their kind of brightest kids would often come to America for graduate school, and a reasonable number of them would stay. Now, a lot of them go back because they have a domestic industry that can support them. But also, we are suggesting that we don't want international students, especially from countries like China, and that over time, that's not something you're going to see in the short run affect us, but in terms of long run productivity, I think it will, and innovation.
Yeah. So you talked about that in the piece, and I'd like you to elaborate on that. The U.S. relies for its thriving economy on an educated workforce, and we have had the benefit up until quite recently of being a magnet for some of the brightest minds around the globe. And that's not happening to the same degree anymore for a variety of reasons, but including what our new policies are, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I was talking to Nicholas Christakis, who's the professor at Yale, who's really, really excellent. But one thing he said to me that's always stuck with me is that America's superpower was that we brain drained the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And that's basically been true for the last century. You know, we know that a lot of our innovation is driven by the fact that we have not just an attractive place for lots of immigrants to come to, but also world-class research institutions, world-class research universities, world-class companies, a lot of them started by people who came over originally for that reason, or whose parents came over for that reason. And that has driven a lot of the technological innovation that we see today, and is responsible ultimately for a reasonable amount of the growth that we have. You know, immigrants who come to America tend to be more entrepreneurial. Their kids tend to do well.
They're more likely to start businesses.
Yes.
Than native-born people.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So if we simultaneously, you know, there are a few things that are happening. And I have a separate piece today about what happens if we hit net zero migration, mm-hmm. which might be soon, actually, which will be the first time in probably since the Great Depression that we've had more people leaving the country than entering. So if we have a domestic population that is simultaneously getting worse at reading and worse at math, and we are saying to the rest of the world, we don't really want your best and brightest. Harvard needs to be shut down because it's too woke. If you want an H-1B visa, you have to pay $100,000. We don't want that. In 20 years, our domestic labor pool will be the students that we have today. And that just might not be the kind of picture that we want. You know, we might get what we, you know, if Trump and Vance kind of get what they want. I mean, it might not manifest in the higher growth and wages that they're hoping for would come with that.
Sometimes I've written about the American dominance of Nobel Prizes. I mean, if you look at the distribution by country of Nobel Prize winners, it's astounding. The percentage that have come from the United States, something like 40%. It's really huge, much larger than our share of the global economy, and certainly much larger than our population or anything like that. And if you dig down even deeper and you look at the percentage of those Nobel Prize winners who were immigrants to the United States, it's very high.
Yeah.
And so it's a very clear example of how what you said about Nick Christakis saying, you know, we were brain draining the rest of the world. The best and the brightest came here and they were able to do their best work because we had the finest research universities. We had venture capital. We had freedom. We had all the things that you needed to allow the flowering of human creativity. And that's been a boon mostly for us, but also for the whole world.
Yeah.
And so we are hurting our universities now. We are shunning our the most creative. And, you know, by the way, on the subject of the immigration, you know, I don't see this changing with a change of party or administration. I mean, I am dismayed to look around and see that, you know, the Democrats are saying to themselves, well, I guess, you know, I guess we were really, we screwed the pooch on immigration. So now we just have to, you know, be a sort of faint echo of the Republicans on this question. You know, by the way, I think there's a better way. I don't know. I'd be curious what you think about this. Yeah. There's a better way. I mean, they can continue to make the case for immigration, rightly understood immigration that's not, you know, just anybody who wants to come to the country, reform the asylum system, but still be welcoming to high-skilled immigrants, to people who are genuine refugees, and so on and so forth. But I'm afraid that they feel snake bit about this and may not be prepared to make that kind of a balanced case for immigration. And so we may not get a return to the status quo ante. What do you think?
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think that Democrats are right that, you know, people have warm feelings still, I think, towards individual immigrants, particularly those who've been here for a while. But where I think they went wrong and where they were out of step with the American people was the sense that, you know, immigration didn't need to be controlled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was looking at statistics for this separate article I was working on. And over the Biden administration, I mean, 7 million immigrants entered the country, which is the same rate as during the 1840s and 50s. During the great potato famine in Ireland and the revolutions of 1848. I mean, the era of like really disruptive mass migration, which, by the way, then provoked its own nativist reaction in the form of the Know Nothing Party and all of that. And so, you know, this is a cycle that we observe throughout history, is that whenever there are big influxes of migrants, there is an immediate reaction that is negative to it.
Yes.
And so that's kind of how I see the politics of this, is that, you know, wittingly or not, you know, the Biden administration really encouraged a massive inflow of people who, most of whom were not authorized to be here. Some of them came illegally. A lot of them claimed asylum using the fact that, you know, the asylum system was crafted in the 40s, you know, post-World War II. But really what's going on, I think we can say, is that a lot of people are would-be economic migrants. Yes. And they have found out that the asylum system is the best way to get them released into the country. Mm-hmm. And the move that Donald Trump has made that is successful is to say that this is completely chaotic and unacceptable, and we can't do that anymore. And I think on that point, he's correct. Now, he pairs that with, well, we don't want really immigration of any kind. We don't want H-1B recipients. We only want refugees from South Africa. You know, he pairs it. We want to, like, you know, send masked men to deport, you know, people no matter kind of who they are or what.
A gardener, you know, who has three Marine sons.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that part, I think, on that part, I think he's out of step with the rest of the country. But, you know, on this big question of, you know, who should be coming and are do we have a sense of who's coming into the country? I think the Democrats were wrong and therefore have lost a lot of credibility on the issue. And so it would be good if they captured this kind of old, more rational, sensible equilibrium. But, you know, I think they might feel that they actually have to err much closer to Trump in order to compensate for the errors of the last few years.
All right. So so you are now, I will dub you education czar, and you will be able to make reforms throughout the whole country that will improve outcomes. So what are your priorities?
I think you know, the question answers itself. The answer should be outcomes. And I think that I am relatively agnostic about the modes by which we accomplish it. There are things we know that work. We know that phonics instruction works. We know that, you know, literacy coaches work. I think that you can scale some of those ideas relatively well. I'd be interested, you mentioned the new math of the 1970s, and I want to ask you what that was, because one thing that I've observed is a kind of similar touchy-feely kind of mathematics instruction that I haven't dug into it. I haven't written about it yet, but I'd like to. That's emerged where you kind of don't teach kids times tables and just sort of hope that it all gels together at some point. And I don't yet have the vocabulary to talk about it that well.
This is Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun. Okay.
Yeah.
New math was the idea that you don't drill and kill. Okay. You don't do times tables. You don't do any of those sorts of things. You teach kids the ideas of mathematics. And so we sat in third and fourth grade learning set theory.
Wow.
And addition is commutative and subtraction is something. And it was all very abstract and utterly inappropriate for the age that we were. Meanwhile, skipping the drilling that, alas, is part of building the building blocks of being able to do higher math, you have to start with multiplication tables and long division and all those boring things. But if you don't do them, if you try to take a cheat around them, you're damaging the kids. And I personally was damaged. I never really became competent in math, because I was taught new math and also I was bad at it. But that, I mean, so you combine. So I was a perfect example, right? Of like what we were talking about a minute ago with, you know, a kid. Now, when it came to reading, I came from a house that had lots of books and all that. But when it came to math, like I don't have a lot of natural math ability. And so I needed that, drilling and basic instruction in school that would have compensated for my own lack of natural talent.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. So it was crippling.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry to hear that, because math is fun. And set theory is really, it's a bit like CRT, right? It's really a college subject. It doesn't belong in schools.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that there, you know, again, depending on how dictatorial my control is, I think that there are curricular
full power.
There are curricular changes to what we teach kids in terms of reading, in terms of math. I think making sure that, you know, the ethnic studies stuff, I'm a bit skeptical of that's emerging. You know, I think that, you know, the basics are what you need to focus on. And then I think we have to think about what we teach teachers, because I think that there is a decent amount of bloat in what's taught to actual teachers. There's a lot of credentialism as well, where you need a master's degree in order to become a principal. And I don't know what you're learning in those classes, but, you know, more direct pedagogy, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how you teach kids how to do long division, as opposed to the abstract, you know, let's read Frantz Fanon stuff. Yeah. I think that's important to look at. I think how we pay teachers could also be varied based on ability.
That they're
better teachers than others. We need to think about how we advance the good teachers and how we help the poor teachers, or maybe tell them that there is something else that they could be doing. And in that way, make teaching a profession that really successful, talented people want to go into because they can see how they can advance. We need to think about how we support teachers in schools in terms of giving them coaching, master teachers who float around, who tell kids how to learn. And I think that to me, choice can be great. I think that there are some really high performing charter schools in Newark, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, that all have really good evidence behind them. And actually, a lot of the reason for that is that because those places are inherently skeptical of charters, they have very strict accountability measures for those charter schools. If you are a poor performing charter school in Boston, you won't last very long. Mm-hmm, your charter mm-hmm. will be revoked. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the analogy that I think needs to apply to other places. So for that reason, the voucher program is sometimes it's not driven by this idea that you're going to improve outcomes for kids. It's driven by this idea that choice is inherently a good thing for parents to have. Be that as it may, I think that for me, the most important thing would be the actual outcomes and making sure that if you are, expanding the choice set of parents, that's great. But are you actually improving outcomes? And if you're not improving outcomes, I think that I would have a lot of questions about that policy.
And there's one more thing you mentioned that you might want to add to your list, which is you would cut back on the, no late penalties for missed homework and being able to retake tests and so on, which you think is kids are that asks too little of the students, right?
I think so. I also think you should do the Jonathan Haidt idea and lock up smartphones and don't.
Yeah.
I mean, that all makes sense. I mean,
that is catching on, which is kind of encouraging. Maybe not even so much for the educational outcomes as for the social outcomes.
Yeah.
Really important that kids talk to each other. I mean, it's I remember reading about a middle school principal who said that the lunchroom used to be the noisiest place on campus until the smartphones came along.
Wow.
And then all the kids were just sitting there on their phones, not even talking to the people right next to them.
That's true of adult spaces
noises.
Too. Restaurants, bars, all of those kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
Everyone at bars staring at their phone.
All right, Idris, this is a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me. And thank you all for listening. And hope you'll come back next week.